Good morning and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. Ballot initiatives and wildfires were in the news last week. We'll hear about proposed initiatives in Washington and Oregon that could significantly change the way the states collect and manage revenue. Stigma is a major barrier preventing people with mental health needs from getting help, according to a new Iowa State University study. One in five people in the United States struggles with some form of mental illness, 137,000 in Oregon. Those who look for help wait up to 11 years on average before finally getting treatment. We'll hear comments from Daniel Lannan, report author and clinical intern at Iowa State. All that and more on this edition of The Bridge. Tens of thousands of Oregonians got a raise last week. The state's minimum wage went up for the first time in 18 months. Salem correspondent Chris Lehman has details.
The amount of the increase depends on where you work. The wage goes up a quarter an hour in rural counties and 50 cents an hour everywhere else. Full-time minimum wage workers will see their paycheck go up $20 per week before taxes. Workers like Cassiel Capriel, she works at Portland International Airport, helping people in wheelchairs get to and from their flights.
It's okay because it's going to make a little difference, but we still need more of that.
Capriel says she does get tips sometimes, but she says often it's only enough to pay for her light rail ticket back home. Next year, Oregon moves to a three-tiered system, which gives workers in the Portland metro area a higher rate than the rest of the state. The minimum wage will automatically go up each July for the next 6 years. At that point, it will return to the old system of being adjusted based on the Consumer Price Index. I'm Chris Lehman in Salem.
Those new wage laws kicking in today will give a slight boost to the paychecks of more than 100,000 low-income Oregonians, while tourists and vacationers will have a little less spending money. The changes enacted by the legislature earlier this year will almost double Oregon's 1% tax on hotel stays and raise the current $9.25 hourly minimum wage by 50 cents in Metro Portland and smaller cities such as Eugene and Salem, 25 cents in rural areas. The lodging tax increase will help create a $25 million subsidy for the 2021 World Track and Field Championships in Eugene and will increase state tourism funds overall. The wage hike was narrowly approved by Oregon lawmakers in March as an attempt to head off potential ballot measures that would have increased the minimum wage more rapidly. The new wage laws kicking in will give a slight boost to the paycheck of more than 100,000 low-income Oregonians, while tourists and vacationers will have a little less spending money. The changes enacted by the legislature earlier this year will almost double Oregon's 1% tax on hotel stays and raise the current $9.25 hourly minimum wage by 50 cents in Metro Portland and smaller cities such as Eugene and Salem, 25 cents in rural areas. The lodging tax will help create a $25 million subsidy for the 2021 World Track and Field Championships in Eugene and increase state tourism funds overall. The share of taxes Oregon collects from corporations has dropped significantly over the last four decades. According to a report released by the Oregon Center for Public Policy, the corporate share of income tax in the mid-70s was more than 18%. Today, it's less than 7%. Juan Carlos Ordonez, communications director for the Oregon Center for Public Policy, said the state has not come up with a way to fill the budget hole left by lower taxes on corporations.
Oregon has one of the nation's most crowded classrooms, shorter school years, and there's a great deal of need. And it's certainly, to some extent, the burden being shifted to families and individuals, but also just the hole not being filled.
Ordonez says a number of policies have led to the sharp decline in taxes collected from corporations. For instance, the report says before 1980, there were 9 federal and state tax breaks available for corporations. Today, there are 51. The tax rate for corporations could change this November, however. On this year's ballot is the Business Tax Increase Initiative, which would raise the rate 2.5% on corporations with incomes that exceed $25 million per year. According to Oregon's Legislative Revenue Office, the measure would net the state $3 billion a year. Ordonez says that money would be much-needed windfall for Oregon's underfunded state services.
It would go a long way in filling the needs of our K-12 schools and putting in resources to work for addressing the needs of our seniors and other important needs for our state.
The report cites two different studies showing Oregon has the lowest effective tax rate in the country for businesses. Signatures are due tomorrow for November ballot measures in Washington state. A shortage of signature gatherers has made this year's efforts especially hectic. Amy Radel explains.
Peter McCollum is the campaign manager for Integrity Washington. His group has raised $1.8 million. Their chances for getting on the ballot in November are looking good.
We've gathered more than 250,000 signatures already, and we're confident that we're going to have around 330,000 at least.
They need 246,000 valid signatures to qualify. McCollum says his measure includes public financing for campaigns.
Initiative 1464 reforms Washington State's ethics and campaign finance laws to create greater transparency and accountability, to limit undue influence of big money in politics, and to give voters in Washington State more of a voice.
But getting the signatures has not been easy. McCollum says signature gatherers often migrate here after California's deadline is finished. But California extended its deadline this year, so the workforce showed up later.
And we did have to pay a little bit more than we anticipated for signature gathering because of the shorter timeline. But that was an adjustment that needed to be made.
Other initiative backers say meeting Friday's deadline will be a challenge. The campaign for restrictions on transgender bathroom access, called Just Want Privacy, has just 150,000 signatures and has raised $180,000. Spokeswoman Kaylee Triller-Haver says they're relying equally on paid gatherers and volunteers.
The paid effort is expensive. I mean, we could contract out at a dollar a signature, but it's not going to compete with these things that are backed by millionaires, where they're getting $4 per signature.
Initiative 1515 would repeal rules guaranteeing transgender people access to the bathrooms and locker rooms of their gender identity.
I think you'll hear a lot of transgender people say, we've been using the bathrooms and locker rooms for 10 years without incident. And I think most of us would agree that's true. Because honestly, if somebody looks like a female and is being discreet, that's not the issue. Our initiative would just restore that status quo and allow businesses to determine their own policies.
The initiative would also require public schools to keep transgender girls, for example, out of locker rooms when other girls are changing. Failure to do so would be grounds for a lawsuit. I'm Amy Radel reporting.
State court judges in Oregon are disproportionately male and white. This according to a new study called The Gavel Gap, released by the American Constitution Society for Law and Policy. The study says both men and women of color are underrepresented in the judiciary compared with the state's demographics. Co-author of the Gavel Gap study, Tracy George, says the state courts decide more than 90% of Americans' judicial business, and it's important that the courts reflect the nation.
Any group of people, when they decide cases, they're always going to be affected by their experiences. It affects how we see disputes. It affects how we understand facts. So we want judges to have the range of backgrounds and attributes that bear on the kinds of cases they hear.
According to the study, white men make up 37% of Oregon's population, but are over half of all state judges. Oregon ranked third in the nation when it comes to closing race and gender gaps on state court benches. George says the biggest challenge she faced conducting this study was finding information about the judges themselves. Judges often work behind a cloak of secrecy.
It would go a long way in filling the needs of our K-12 schools and putting in resources to work for addressing the needs of our seniors and other important needs for our state.
Nationally, white men are nearly twice as represented on state judiciaries as in the population. Meanwhile, women of all races make up 51% of the population, but only 30% of state judges. People of color are 38%, but make up just 20% of Oregon state judges. Oregon lawmakers will try again next year to round up support for a major transportation funding package. The previous attempt got sidelined amid disputes over a separate bill. As part of the effort to craft a new next version, a state legislative committee is touring the state trying to figure out what to include. Correspondent Chris Lehman caught up with the panel at their stop last week in Hermiston.
I'm standing near the end of the off-ramp at exit 177 on Interstate 84 in eastern Oregon. It's a little-used interchange, just a mere fraction of the traffic that a typical exit in the Portland area would get each day. But local officials say they expect, and in fact hope, that traffic increases at this interchange in the coming years as the nearby Umatilla Army Chemical Depot transitions to a National Guard base and a business industrial park that's expected to draw more truck traffic in the coming years. And that's why they're proposing to upgrade this lonely interchange to modern standards. Streets in town are on the agenda, too. Local leaders pointed out problem spots to lawmakers on a bus tour of the region.
And we do have a considerable number of rear-end accidents.
Of course, those local leaders are keenly aware that they are competing against the rest of the state. During a hearing in the auditorium of the town's high school, Hermiston Mayor Dave Drotzman figured he'd tip the scales a bit by presenting lawmakers with some of his city's trademark watermelons.
Those are fresh out of the field this morning. Please feel free to take those home with you today.
Though Drotzman conceded it was a little early in the summer for really good melons.
They're probably not as good as the end of July, where our watermelons are the sweetest, but they're probably better than anything you can find in the local markets that you have close to your homes.
And with lawmakers anticipating the juicy melons that awaited them, the mayor fired up the PowerPoint presentation and showed a picture of a bumper-to-bumper traffic jam in downtown Hermiston.
Every afternoon around 3 o'clock, traffic stacks up like this because many people in the community use...
Not every request was for a road improvement project. Mary Jo Carpenter is the Baker County manager for an organization called Community Connection of Northeast Oregon. She helps organize transportation for mobility-impaired people.
There's no other way for them to get around. I mean, our local taxi service doesn't have an accessible vehicle.
Carpenter is hoping lawmakers will include funding for increased public transit in places like Baker City, but she doesn't know how they'll pay for it.
I wish I had the magic answer to the funding source, but I don't.
Lawmakers are still looking for that formula, too. Republican Representative Greg Smith's district includes Hermiston.
We got to be careful when we talk about how we're going to pay for this, because that's a very broad conversation, and it's going to be based upon the needs throughout the state of Oregon. People need to remember that the gas tax can only be used for roads.
He's right. The Oregon Constitution prohibits gas tax revenue from being used for anything other than highways. So improvements to public transit, or rail lines, or port facilities, would all have to be paid for with other kinds of revenue, such as higher fees on driver's licenses or vehicle registrations. Smith says it's too early to say what those sources would be, but he says one thing is certain.
Any transportation package that gets passed is going to have to benefit the entire state of Oregon.
And Smith says that means people in his rural eastern Oregon district would have to come to terms with paying for improvements to Portland area roads, just like lawmakers from the Portland area would have to be comfortable paying for highway upgrades in places like Hermiston. I'm Chris Lehman reporting.
An estimated 137,000 Oregonians have mental health needs, but stigma could be keeping some of them from seeking help. New research measured how 370 college students responded when given the opportunity to learn more online about mental health services. Daniel Lannan is the study's lead author at the University of Iowa. He says even in private and anonymous settings, someone with greater self-stigma is less likely to take the first step. getting information about the help that's available.
Stigma means that a person is putting labels on themselves, like I'm weak, I'm disturbed, because they're believing what some parts of society are telling them about having a mental health concern or seeking counseling.
Lannan says many people still feel uncomfortable or threatened by mental illness, and these views often lead to discrimination or exclusion in social or work settings. He says as a result, people who need help have a harder time admitting there's a problem. Lannan says the study illustrates the need for better interventions, but adds that can be tricky because efforts are often rejected. According to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, 3/4 of all chronic conditions begin by age 24. Lannan says for many young adults, it's a time of transition. Going to college, working full-time, moving away from home, having a family. All add to the reasons they may not seek help. He notes by the time someone shows symptoms of distress, they're often struggling to function.
Functionally, in areas of their life, they're being impaired. They might miss work. They might miss class. In some cases, they might struggle with even hygiene, or they might strongly contemplate suicide.
1 in 5 people struggles with mental illness in the United States, according to Lannan, and those who look for help wait 11 years on average before finally getting treatment. He says the solution for removing stigma as a barrier needs to be addressed both at societal and individual levels for people to feel more comfortable taking those first steps to wellness. It is wildfire season in the West again, and a wildfire that broke out near Clallam over the weekend was contained, according to the Kittitas County Sheriff's Office. The 50-acre fire caused several homes to be evacuated and threatened a chimpanzee sanctuary. According to correspondent Anna King, the chimps sounded the first warnings.
Jamie, a female chimp, let out a soft, high-pitched call when she spotted a plume of smoke rising outside. The other chimps turned their heads to look. Then the human caretakers noticed and dialed 911. Staff scrambled, got all the chimps inside and safe, turned on emergency sprinklers, and evacuated staff. Diana Goodrich says she's still worried despite multiple helicopters working the fire. Chimps Foxy and Jody are still the most nervous.
They are grooming each other right now and looking out the window, watching the helicopters, just like the humans are, just keeping an eye on how things are going.
The sanctuary is home to 6 females and 1 male. I'm Anna King reporting.
The wildfire is called Heart Road Fire. It burned in the same area where the massive Taylor Bridge Fire burned several years ago. The federal government and a nonprofit group say they'll work with private property owners to reduce the risk of wildfire and protect rivers in the West. The United States Forest Service, the Natural Resource Conservation Service, and the American Forest Foundation said the $5 million program will include California, Colorado, Montana, and Oregon. Another project will be selected in the Four Corners region, comprising Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico, and Utah. The American Forest Foundation says the work targets areas at high risk of wildfire that could cause erosion and other problems for vital waterways. The project includes areas in California's Sierra Nevada range, the South Platte watershed in the mountains west of Denver, the headwaters of the Missouri River in Montana, and the Blue Mountains of Oregon. And if the fire itself wasn't enough, the Federal Aviation Administration has emailed 500,000 drone owners in its registry this week to remind them to stay away from wildfire. Close calls between hobby drones and firefighting aircraft persist across the West despite repeated warnings. Correspondent Tom Bonsi has more.
National Interagency Fire Center spokeswoman Jennifer Jones says she understands the temptation.
It's obviously very, you know, attractive, interesting footage. And we just believe that a lot of the folks aren't aware of the risk, the safety risk that they're creating.
Jones says a drone sighting results in firefighting aircraft being grounded until the airspace is clear. The National Fire Center in Boise has already documented rogue drone incursions at 12 Western wildfires this year, and it's still early in fire season.
We've been doing everything that we can think of to try to get the word out through a lot of different channels.
The FAA can levy steep penalties for interfering at a wildfire, but most of the time the foolhardy drone pilots vanish before they can be located. I'm Tom Botsy reporting.
Jones said unauthorized drones have been spotted this year in wildfires in California, Montana, Arizona, Nevada, Utah, Alaska, and Minnesota, resulting in aerial operations being temporarily shut down on at least six occasions. The NIFC has learned of approximately 20 unauthorized drone incursions during the last year's fire season, when there were fewer of the small remote-controlled quadcopters and airplanes in hobbyist hands. The numbers of small privately owned drones has quadrupled, and owners are reminded that they must register with the FAA. And in our final report on fire, for this edition anyway, we learn from Anna King that Northwest firefighters this summer are developing something called flame length brain. That means how tall wildfires will likely get this summer, especially east of the Cascades. It's a way of figuring the potential difficulty of a fire. The taller the flames climb, the harder and more predictable they will become to fight. Anna King explains.
There was a lot of rain this winter here. Then it turned really hot, drought city. So now all this high grass is really dry like hay. Plus many areas in the Columbia Basin haven't burned in a while. So the buildup of dead grass and fuel on the ground could make really tall fire. Where sometimes we might only see fires a foot or two tall, top experts told me this year fires could be 15 to 20 feet tall. When they get that big, they rip fast across the landscape in unpredictable ways.
That's all we have time for on this edition of The Bridge. If you missed any part of it or just want to hear it again, it is available as a podcast on our website at coastradio.org. We appreciate your comments and questions. You can email us at news1, that's N-E-W-S and the numeral 1, at KMUN.org. Please put The Bridge in the subject line. And you can like us on Facebook. I'm Kate Brister. Thank you for listening. Join us next time on The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.